Season 3 of Ricardo's Rules of Resilience podcast is brought to you by Triple R Nutrition. Triple R Nutrition offers you top-of-the-line supplements while supporting a worthy cause. Triple R Nutrition is partnered with Wired and Vision in El Salvador, so part of their proceeds go towards helping support their mission in El Salvador. So you can make sure that you're maximizing your potential while supporting a worthy cause. Go check them out.
That's right. Ricardo's Rules of Resilience. Tune in, people. Every episode is impactful. You become more burly just by listening. Let's go.
Welcome, everybody, to Ricardo's Rules of Resilience podcast, the podcast that gives you the tools to withstand and recover from difficulties. Today, we are privileged to be joined by our special guest. And now we're going to have to upgrade you to more than special guest, but friend of the show. This is Dylan Scott's second appearance with us. He was good enough to come on this summer when he won the DECA Ultra held in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And now we are coming fresh off of another world championship. And this time it is in the DecaFit World Championship in Ocala, Florida. Welcome, Dylan Scott.
Thank you very much for having me back, Ricardo. Good to be on here.
So we've got so many things I want to talk about with you. But I just got to say, because if I don't say it up front, I'm be thinking about it the whole time. And so I just got to say, you got up on that victory platform. You won the Elite World Championship for DECA Fit, which for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with Spartan DECA, it's 10 functional fitness stations. Each one of those stations is preceded by a 500-meter run. And it's a very difficult race. You have to be in extremely, extremely good shape. I'm not saying I'm in extremely good shape, but, you know, I keep myself moving. And I think my time is, you know, my PR time is like 40 minutes or 41 minutes. What'd you put that thing down in?
29:05.
Just flat flying. It was incredible to watch. And when you did this, you get first in the world. You go up on the podium. You're going to get a check for winning. And you decided to take the podium wearing a raccoon fur coat. That was full length, head to toe raccoon fur. And I was standing in the audience, and I turned to whoever was beside me, and I thought they would know, and I said, "Is that raccoon fur?" And they said, "I don't know." But then later I saw on social media that it was. That was so boss. And I just gotta say, because I know you and, you know, the time we spent together in our first interview and how humble you are.
Yeah.
I just want to say, before I knew any of the backstory, I thought, that is super cool. Other people would have done that same thing, and I'd have thought, man, that guy's kind of a jerk. He's kind of a showboat. But knowing you, I just looked at it in pure admiration. I was like, oh, that is just so cool. The hybrid raccoon is in a raccoon fur coat.
I really appreciate that, and I appreciate the fact that I got to say. So the coat came from Jeff Barton.
Yep.
So he was the one who ended up giving it to
those those who don't know, Jeff is works for Spartan. He is the announcer. He is the voice of DECA. I think he does all the DECA fits, all the world championships. He also does big Spartan races, such as the one at Notre Dame Stadium. So he's he's a big DECA announcer for and Spartan announcer for those who don't know. But, yeah, go ahead, Dylan, with the story.
Yeah. So the backstory with the jacket is, so that was – jacket was bought about 40 years ago by Jeff's mom, okay? Jeff's mom bought this jacket, and they – hate the whole family. They couldn't stand it. They're like, "This is why'd you buy this jacket? This thing's so just." And so it hung in the closet. And now she has since passed away. And once she passed away, it got divided between either Jeff's sister or him. And he was the one that had it, and it just hung in his closet. So a couple years roll around, and Jeff and I end up meeting through the DecaFit circuit. We end up all getting into a fantasy football league together, where Jeff is really good at fantasy football and I'm really bad. And so, Yeah, dude, I suck at fantasy football. I get demolished. So we're in there talking in the fantasy football league, and then, you know, it's probably a year and a half ago, Jeff's like, hey, we've got this raccoon coat that used to be my mom's and it hangs in my closet and nobody touches it. And I think it would be perfect for you. And he's like, if I mail it to you, will you keep it and like make sure that you take care of it? And if you're going to pass it to anybody else, make sure that they've got a plan and a purpose for it. And I was like, absolutely, send it to me. So he says that a year and a half ago, and that's been hanging in the closet. And every so often I'll look at it and I'll be like, it's my raccoon coat. And he texts me about 3 days before I'm going to fly down to Ocala. And he goes, hey, you got that coat, don't you? I said, absolutely, Jeff. I told you wasn't anything going to happen to it. He said, pack it. I said, pack it and wear that thing on the podium. He said, go win and wear it on the podium. And I had just enough confidence in myself that I said, yeah, I'm going to pack it. So I stuffed that sucker in there, trying to get all my race shoes in. I'm like, dude, if I have to get another bag because I can't fit a raccoon coat in here, I'm like, it might be worth $45, but hell, we're going to do it anyway. So I'm getting stuffed in there, and I bring it down, and I haven't told anybody. The only person – there's like two people that know. Jeff knows, and then Tara Jackson, she knew about it because she and I are great friends. So I stop by the house, and I'm like, yo, you want to see something? I said, if I win tomorrow – we're putting this baby on. So I go out. I have a very good race. I end up winning, and I had it packed into my book bag. And so awards come around, and Jeff's over to me. He's like, you brought the jacket, didn't you? I was like, Jeff, yeah, of course I brought the jacket, man. It's in my bag over there. So he starts going off. He announces Nick Riker for getting third, and he announces Grayson Kilgore for getting second. I'm waiting till the last minute to pull the sucker out. And then you just hear him, and we've been waiting 40 years for this moment. And I'm like, get out. And I put that thing on, and I'm like, I'm about to strut up there. And the good thing is, like you said, I know that everyone in the community knows me. Yeah. And they know that that move right there is nothing that is supposed to be, like, prideful and audacious. Yeah. It is nothing more than, hey, guys, y'all want to see something hilarious?
Yeah.
And let's go make a moment. It was just, let's make a moment. And it was very
– yeah.
It was beautiful to see something come full circle like that.
It really was. Yes, your reputation preceded you, and the family atmosphere and the community among the competitors, it did. It just came off flawlessly. It's just a very special moment. You know, it's kind of like somebody pulling a prank at Christmas. You know, I mean, it's just like, that's how it was. Just a family atmosphere. The celebration, I just had to get that out of the way. And we're going to actually kind of work backwards from that because we have some really, really deep stuff. So, listeners, the plan today, we had to talk about the hybrid raccoon, Dylan's nickname, wearing an all-raccoon head-to-toe fur coat on top of the podium. But before that was the race, and before that was some lessons in resilience. And Dylan has been good enough to come on to our show to help you, our listener, learn the lessons of resilience that have propelled him into a championship. Because as you heard in our first episode with Dylan, this is not the guy who's been climbing to the top of the podium since he was 4 years old. One of the things, great things about Dylan is he has had to overcome and fight and show resilience his whole life. And this championship was no exception. I can't wait to get to that part. But before we get there, let's talk about the race itself. I got to be there, and, you know, the first, I would say, as memory serves, it was a long weekend, a lot of races, but as I recall, the first six stations, it was a race, and then somewhere around seven or eight, it was pretty clear the race was for second place. You were just way ahead of everybody else. So could you walk us through how the race went for you?
Yeah, so I knew – how everybody was going to have to race and where they were going to be, you know, strong at, where I had deficiencies against them. And basically I looked at, you know, the two guys that ended up on the podium with me as well, Nick Riker and Grayson Kilgore. I was worried about both of them, and I was worried about Nick
for good cause
because of his running prowess.
Yeah.
Yeah. For good cause. He's got really good running prowess. He also works the bike really well. Now I knew where his weaknesses were, and that was going to be just a little bit of the functional stations as well as the ergs. And so I targeted the ski erg. That was where I was like, this is where the move will happen. I knew for two reasons. One, I get away on the ski erg from Nick, and I didn't think after that he was going to have it in him to run me down anywhere else. I also knew that I had to get ahead of Grayson pretty early and start building a gap because his last three stations are fairly strong. He'll come off of the bike pretty well. He doesn't D-ball as great as you would think, but then he moves the tank well and he burpees really fast. And so my whole thing was if I can put 25 seconds into everybody going into the burpees, no one can catch me. And so that was really the strategy. I let the front end of the race went off really, really fast. And I just didn't feel comfortable sprinting up to the front like that. And I was like, that's fine. You guys take it. There were a couple of guys that were running ahead of me that I was like, if we were just doing a running race, you have no business being in front of me. So you can be there right now. And I'll let the first 8 minutes of this race kind of play out. And then I will take control after that. And that's really what happened. I came into the lunges maybe sixth. I came out probably eighth. We got into the rower. I came into the rower probably seventh and then came out third, ran my way up to Nick's shoulder, and then once I made the pass on him going into the med ball sit-ups and then opened a gap up going into the ski erg, I was like, I'm going to put 12 seconds into you here, and then I'm just going to start breaking everybody mentally. I was like, once they see the gap that I'm going to create, I think they're going to believe it's insurmountable, and I'm just going to keep telling myself, make it bigger. And that was the race plan, and it really went exactly how I wanted it to.
Mm. You got to love it when a plan comes together.
Yeah, got to love it when a plan comes together.
I love that. And I will say that for those of our listeners who are wondering, what can I do? And I've coached people through this, what can I do about those pre-race jitters? And I tell them, well, we focus on the things we can control. You can't control the outcome. Mm-hmm. You can control your preparation, right? And you can control the plan. Focus on the plan. I will follow the plan, and I will give my best effort. I'll give the effort I'm supposed to give at each spot in the competition, whether it's a sport or whether it's a hybrid racing. I'm going to follow the plan and give the right amount of effort at the right time. And when you focus on what you can control, then the results will take care of themselves. And that's exactly how it worked out for you.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a thing that we talk about within the company that I work for, and it's called what's in your sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. And if you're taking care of everything that's in your sphere of influence, and of course that sphere can be different. It could be in a sports context. It could be in a relationship context, whatever. But once you've evaluated everything and you've said, all right, this is now outside of my sphere of influence, that doesn't matter anymore. I cannot affect it. There were 14 other guys in the field, and the only thing that I could do to influence them was to show them my back getting further and further away. And that was it.
Yeah.
There's nothing else I could do to those guys. So I didn't worry about what they were doing. I worried about what I was doing. And as long as I was doing what my plan was, I said, there's no one who can beat that plan out here right now.
Yeah.
And that was how I raced.
Confidence in the preparation, confidence in the plan, and stick to it and execute it. But the preparation and the race day did not come without significant challenges. And I just admire the fact that you're willing to be open and vulnerable about those. So you came off of the championship we talked about at the top of the podcast here, of Deca Ultra, which is 5 Deca fits, and just another superhuman performance. I mean, you were blasting those away in about, give or take, 31 minutes each, back to back to back. And then, a world championship and the Deca Ultra got a huge full, what was that, like a 24-inch trophy?
They sent the sub-3-hour Ram. If you could break 3 hours, they set the mark for 3 hours for that Ultra, and I was like, that's a pretty good mark. And I thought in my head, maybe I'd go 250, and then going 242, I was, just like, all right, well, I far exceeded my own expectations and everybody else's, so... that's always fun when you do that.
Oh, yeah. But as always, you come off of the mountain and there's always a valley, right?
For sure. For sure. And that valley came in other sports, in high rocks and stuff like that. I was having some struggles there, taking international trips to go race and then putting out results that I thought weren't reflective of the fitness I had. And just, that was tough. managed to rebound from that race well again. But yeah, I came into that race down in Florida in a, you know, bad place mentally. Mm-hmm. And I think it was reflective in my pre-race demeanor, my intra-race demeanor. Post-race, there was a little more smiles because, of course, you know, you feel good when you win. But then you also come down off of that high when you get home and you're alone. Like, mm-hmm. you get away from everybody who's giving you a pat on the back and a high five.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you feel like there are just times when things don't feel like you think they should. Mm-hmm. They're not in alignment with what you think you should feel for this moment. And there's a lot of external factors at times that play into it. And I would say that going into that race Friday and winning and the feeling I had when I got home and was just kind of standing by myself early in the morning, some of that was internal, some of that was external,
mm-hmm.
where there were things going on in my life at that moment that I was like, I've become really cold and hollow right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it sucks that I cannot feel the joy that I think I should be feeling because of everything else. But you learn to function through that kind of stuff. I would say fortunately, you don't want to function in that state in a continual basis, right. because it does make life really bleak. You know, you just walk around and it's kind of all black and white. You're missing all the color. You're still getting the image, but you're missing a lot of the color. But sometimes you have to race like that.
Yeah.
You know, you have to line up and you have to show up for things. And that doesn't always have to be a race, but it could just be an important event where you have to be more than what it is that you want to be at that moment.
That's right.
And you got to figure out how to show up either for yourself or for somebody else. In this case, I had to show up for myself. And I'll tell you, when you're dealing with depression and stuff like that, sometimes it's harder to show up for yourself than it is to show up for another person.
That's right.
Because you'll show up for another person because you see value in them. You're like, they deserve this. When you're deep in depression, you don't feel like you deserve anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't want to show up for yourself. But on that day, at least, I was like, I had a lot of conversations about not even going down there. You know, I looked at just being like, I'm just going to take a loss on that flight. I'm just going to unbook that hotel. I don't want to leave. But I showed up for myself that day and it paid off.
Mm-hmm. What do you think or tell us as you're going into weeks and months and you're dealing with this depression, how do you find, what were the things that you did to be able to find the strength to train and to be a dad and to keep your job? Mm-hmm. Because as you said, the race is not always a race. Sometimes the race is just making dinner for my kids, right? Sometimes the race is just getting to work on time and getting the things done that I got to get done because I got to feed my family and I got to pay this mortgage, right? And so the race can be different for each of us. But in your case, you not only had a literal race coming up, a competition for which, you know, there's a substantial prize on the line. There's that financial reward, but you had to keep working. You have to keep being a dad. Talk to us about all of that.
Yeah, so I think in kind of what I said earlier, sometimes it's easier to show up for other people than it is for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say that with like with my son, luckily, even if there's been times when I've just been feeling kind of broken.
Mm-hmm.
And all I want to do is I just hold him for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just go find him and I'll just pick him up. And I'll just say, buddy, I need a hug real quick. Because there's this like unbridled freedom and joy that you see in a kid with how they're experiencing the world sometimes. And when you can't see in color, they're seeing it for you.
Mm-hmm.
They're seeing it in such a bright light that you're like, I see it for a minute. Okay.
Yeah.
And so that's how you can show up for them. In those times you're like, it's dark, it's bad. He doesn't understand that, which is a good thing, honestly,
mm-hmm.
because he doesn't know that, hey, dad's having a tough time right now.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. because he's still going to ask something from you. And I don't know, when you're being asked by something that seems that pure, it brings you out of it for a minute.
Yeah.
So it's not to say that I was in like a perpetual state of depression, but there were definitely times where it was just a moment with him was enough to be like, okay, like that. Okay. We're good for a second. We can do this. So I think you have that. This isn't something that's new to me. I've dealt with it for a long period. I've dealt with it through like high school, college, you know, in mid-20s, stuff like that. I'm 29. And like even during all of those times when I would have things that I just had to get done, you know, and I don't know how they always get done, but you just find a way. You just find a way. And then sometimes you work through it, you pour yourself into it, you get it done, and then you just kind of collapse. You're done. And you feel a little broken, and you're like, I gave it everything I had. I made it through, but man, that was everything I had. And you go back and you just kind of seclude yourself, which is not always the best thing to do, and just try to revamp to go back out there. But so, I mean, I looked at everything the same way. There were times that I had to fly to a different state and then drive somewhere and go to meetings. And, you know, I would be like, the last thing I want to do is go to an airport and get on a plane and travel up the East Coast and then drive 3 hours and then go into a manufacturing setting and be, you know, completely change my schedule so that I'm on like the shift schedule of the workers there so that I can work with folks. But you just have to get it done. Like,
yeah.
If you think about just on a raw human level, the amount of trials and tribulations that people have had to go through over time, like compared to what we live in now. And you're like, somehow humanity has made it this far. Like there are people who, you know, there are people who were sucking it up way more than you. And I know that it's not a comparison of who's suffering the most, but it's like, are you sure this is your breaking point? I know you're close, but I have a feeling that there might be a little something else in there if you'll just shut the voice up in your head that's making everything a little worse than it really is and just move. That's another thing that we say in the company is action soothes anxiety. And so, like, we work on that. When you're feeling anxious about something, you're like, this isn't, like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. Shut up and do it. I guarantee you'll feel better if you do it.
Yeah. You know, I had a good friend of mine. I was going through an extremely difficult time, a process where my marriage was falling apart. The future of my family was in trouble. And there was this, it was an emotionally wrenching time where there's this affair going on that I can do nothing about. And you know, where am I going to live and what am I going to do for a living? All of these things happened to be up in the air at once. And I was having to move myself and the kids, and we were in a totally different state. I mean, it was just that point that you're talking about of, I feel like I cannot do anything. I just don't have it. I can't get up off of my butt right now and walk across the room and do what has to be done.
Yep.
And a friend of mine I was on the phone with, and he told me this story, and he said, you know, my mother was, you know, when my father died, I think they had been married maybe 50 or 60 years, you know, and they were farmers up in Canada. They had always attended this same church, you know, country church for decades. You know, you can kind of picture the setting where everybody knows
everybody.
And the Sunday after her husband passed, she was getting ready to go into the same church where they had spent decades together, you know, sat in the, you know, same pews, sat side by side, just packed with memories. And the son said to the mother, you know, Mom, like, how could you do, like, how are you able to just get up and face that? And she said, it had to be done. And just facing the reality of this too will pass, and I've got to face it sooner or later, and pulling the covers back over my head and saying, you know, tomorrow, next week, I'll face it then. It's got to be done. I've got to find the strength to be able to do this today. That's what I hear you saying. There's just times where you've said to yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we, if we just functioned off of the whims of what it is that we wanted to do, it would be chaos, you know, if there was no discipline there, if there was no ability to look in the mirror and go, I know that you just desperately don't want to be doing any of this right now, but if you stop, if you stop, it's going to be the biggest mistake you could possibly make.
That's right.
So
that's right.
You just don't stop.
Exactly. You keep going.
Yeah. Sometimes it's that simple.
Yeah.
Like there's no like, hey, what's the special? Nope. You just put one foot in front of the other. You breathe in, you breathe out, and you continue doing that until things end up getting better.
That's right. There's the poet. I was actually going to look it up, but I'll just go from memory and hope my memory's serving me accurately this time. But in the poem, If, by Rudyard Kipling, he says, if you can make your heart and nerve and sinew serve you long after they're gone, and there's nothing left within you except the will that says to them, hold on. It's just that determination that we have to have deep in our souls. Yeah. This is not going to beat me. Yeah. Apropos for the situation, isn't it?
Very much so. And I think it's a kind of a part of the human spirit and that's how we've gotten to where we are, I believe.
Yeah. And there is no win in comparison. I agree with what you're saying. There is no win in comparison, but there's sometimes is some real inspiration and motivation that comes. You know, when I was going through some of the deepest, darkest times, I opened a business January 20th was opening day, January 20th of 2020. I don't know if you remember 2020, but there was a little bit going on in the world.
Not a great time for a business, I know that much.
Yeah. So, yeah, we were open 9 weeks, just 9 weeks, and shut down for the next nine due to COVID. And then we have to reopen and rebuild. And in some of those, it reminded me of what you said, because in some of those darkest times, you know, I'm in this building, I can't even afford to turn the lights and heat on. So it'd be in the cold and in the dark and trying to do virtual things with my clients. And my son would come in and I would do exactly what you just said. And now he's 17 instead of one. I think your son is, you know, he's 17 at that point, but just give me a hug. Let me just hug you for a moment and then feel that power and that love.
It doesn't matter if they're 17 months or 17 years, you know, I haven't gotten to that point yet, but I still I'm here at my mom's house now.
Yeah.
Like I know she's been going through some rough times and you know, I'm 29 and she'll walk up to me and son, I just need a big hug. Like, all right, I get it. You know, that's going to be something that we always need to be close to somebody you love. Cause that gives you more power than if you were alone. Absolutely.
That's right. We're creatures of contact. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. We are.
Very much so.
You know, the other thing that your story reminded me of from my own life, I'm just really enjoying talking to you because it's resonating with me so deeply. But from my own life, another thing that I've done in that comparison time is I have thought, you know what? There were Jewish people who survived the Holocaust, who survived years of abuse and being practically naked in the cold and starvation rations. And somehow they found the will to get up and do it one more day, you know. And like you said, this is so much less than what they're going through, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm at the end of the room.
It's funny that you bring that up because I've sat and thought about that. And I've thought about what it is, like what is the one thing that got somebody through that kind of time.
Yeah.
And I think it honestly comes down to hope.
Mm-hmm.
I think hope is what gets you through that. And so there's a saying that I'll say to myself sometimes, is just like, what is life without hope? And I think it's nothing, because in the deepest, darkest places that you could be, like something like that, if you have hope that somehow it's going to get better, someday you're going to get out, someday things are going to change, you can keep moving forward. But the second that you lose hope that there's any chance for things to get better, I think that's when you're done. That's your breaking point.
Yes, you are exactly right. I've heard it said that we can last weeks without food, days without water, minutes without oxygen, but not even seconds without hope. You're exactly right.
Yeah. Because when that's gone, whatever state you're in, which is probably a very, very terrible state, it becomes permanent.
Yes.
Because there's no leaving it. But yeah, those same things have crossed my mind before. Just, again, thinking about the human spirit and how it is that it deals with certain tribulations, I would say.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, you know, for the people that are listening to this conversation today, and they're looking at you, I mean, here you are from all external appearances. If you weren't willing to share this with the world, nobody would look on you and guess this, right? I mean, you seem to be killing life. Yeah. You're successful in your work. You have this beautiful family, amazing athletic accomplishments, and yet you're dealing with depression. What would you say to our listeners who are identifying with that right now?
I think that a lot of people understand what like kind of masking is, mm-hmm. where you definitely hide that pain, and you hide it for the sake of others sometimes. Mm. Like, I don't want to greet you with my pain. I want to greet you with a smile. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't deserve to feel whatever I'm feeling. Why would I impose that on you? I don't want to feel it. So of course I don't want to pass it on. It's of course you're not going to suddenly become depressed for me, but like, it's still the same thing of like, what is the mood around here? Well, it's pretty bad because Dylan's, he's like a dark cloud, and that's not what I want to be. I don't. So there's that. I think sometimes there's an interplay between the same voices and drive that put you in a depressive state are also the things that cause you to succeed. Mm. Because depending on the way that it's being channeled, sometimes it could really beat you down,
yeah.
And make you stop believing in yourself and, just put you in kind of a state of why even try? Why does it matter? And then other times there can be those things that what they're really doing is they're just asking questions of you, and they're asking you to ask questions of yourself. And in doing so, you go ask those questions, and just the pursuit of doing it ends up leading to accomplishments. Like I've said before, like there's a large part of my athletic achievements that I can only attribute to the fact that I use exercise as a coping mechanism for life. It's not even wrong. Like, I started racing and winning races and doing well because I was training so much. And I was training so much because I was just like, this is how I get through the day. And it just so happens that there's an applicable outlet for it,
mm-hmm.
that can cause me to accrue accolades. And I'm like, it's not hard to boil it down to say, I think Dylan won because he was so sad that he got himself in the best shape he possibly could. And it was like, well, I'm here. I might as well race. there is a part that's just like, I got stupidly fit just because I was like, I have a lot of anxiety, so I'm going to ride a bike and row a lot. And then it was like, well, if you just start structuring those workouts a little bit, there's an entire world called hybrid sports that you could be really good at. So do you want to go that route? And I was like, well, might as well go that route. I'm already doing it anyway. Yeah, it's crazy to say that some of the success is just a byproduct of being like a little mentally ill.
Yeah. You know, I would differ with the label mental illness, but the fact that you're overcoming some real battles deep inside your own soul and your own mind. That's real. That's real.
Yeah.
And our people listening to this need to understand, right, that this life is not happening to you. It's happening for you. And you took, you know, the equivalent of a 1,000-pound weight inside your chest every day and decided, you know what, I could escape to any number of whatever. I could, you know, I could become a sex addict, a gambling addict. I could depend on substances. But instead decided, you know what, this is, I'm going to let this take me somewhere good. I'm going to do something that's going to make me better instead of worse. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. I'm very happy that that's at least the route that my mind is taking, because like I definitely worried about substance abuses and things like that. I know that I have a very kind of what I call a light switch personality, where I'm either on or off. And when I'm on, I'm just full on, and I could be like very hyper focused and addicted to things. And I was like, man, I got to make sure that I don't put myself in bad situations, because I know that there's at least a chance of it going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad that the area of my life that I maybe spend a little too much time is the fitness side of things, because it could be a heck of a lot worse.
Oh yeah. You know, and I just want to say to anybody listening to us today, look, you've got a choice. Dylan's got a choice. Ricardo's got a choice, and you have a choice. When we're battling these very deep, very profound things, you know, am I going to go to war or am I going to run away? And it's only by going to war against them that I'm going to emerge better and not worse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you use any type of counseling or anything like that for dealing with the depression?
So, no, I'm medicated for it on a pretty low dose, like antidepressant that I've been taking for a while.
Mm-hmm.
From a counseling standpoint, I haven't done much on like the therapy end. If we look at things from the mental side of like approaching sports and stuff, or just trying to understand like human nature, I listen to a lot of books on that kind of thing, because I like to at least see like when I have thoughts or when people do actions and I psychoanalyze people a lot, including myself, because I want to try to understand not on the surface level where you're coming from, but like that's when I'll talk with folks and I want to know about their past, their relationships to their family, their stuff like that, because it helps me piece things together to better relate to someone. And I think about it. I've talked with folks before, and even myself, I've had like complicated relationships with my parents to a degree. And I've talked with folks that have had way, way more complicated relationships. And I remember reading one time that like in the relational stages, what you're going to do is like, first you're going to idolize them, and then you're going to demonize them, and then you're going to humanize them. And I've used that a lot to try to relate, especially when I've talked to people who've had hard relationships with folks who should be like their mentors and, you know, above that, because you're going to, at first you look up to them so much and you're like, they can do no wrong. And then as you begin to notice their flaws and everything, you're like, well, why were you so hard on me when you're such a broken person in these areas as well? And then you realize like everybody is like this to a degree.
Yeah.
I think I just listen to a lot of stuff, try to understand human nature, try to understand why I feel the things that I might feel going into races, and how to process all that. Because like, I think if I can give a reason and an understanding to emotion, then I'm good to go. Like I can function with it. Understanding a why to those things can help.
Yes, definitely. Definitely, I agree. So there again, you know, anyone listening in conversation can see, hey, part of how you're dealing with this is to say, I'm going to understand as best I can. I'm going to dig in and press in and not run away from it. Seems to be pretty much the champion's approach to life here is something may press into me, but I'm going to press back every way I can. I like that.
Yeah. I don't chase conflict or anything like that. Don't try to start it. But if a hard conversation needs to happen, if something needs to be done like that, it's very much just a, hey, Like, we're going to buckle down and we're going to do the work to make sure that we're not just turning a blind eye or to something.
Yeah. Even if that conversation's inside, right?
Conversation could be internal or external. Yeah. And sometimes you just have to go, oh man, I have made so many mistakes and I've messed up so much.
Yeah.
When you have that conversation, and you also have to be willing to say all of that and be like, all right. And that might not fix it.
Yep.
That might not fix it. You might recognize all the things you've done wrong, apologize for it, all that kind of stuff. And it's still like, that does not change the circumstances of the outcome here, but at least it makes everything clear. I was going to say, I'll take clarity over comfort any day.
Oh, yes. I love that. Yeah. Oh man, I'm going to write that one down. That's a good one. Clarity over comfort. Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, yeah. Dylan, as we wrap up our time together, you know, I'm so grateful that you would take time to share your experiences with our listeners, help us learn your tools of resilience that have made you a champion despite having obstacles, or maybe it sounds like because you've had obstacles to overcome. You've become a champion. And but before we wrap up, I want to ask you, is there anything I didn't ask you today that you would just love to share with our listeners?
Man, I think we got to go into a lot today. I think we hit a lot of depth. I think that we covered, you know, a lot of the things that were going on surrounding the races, the fun side, the not fun side, the process. Like, I feel like there was a lot in here today. And so there's nothing in particular you hit on or didn't hit on that I'm wanting to, like, specifically point out. No, I think we covered a lot of ground.
Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time. Again, you're busy, you know, in your profession, your career is very demanding, your race schedule is very demanding, and I know you're a committed, you know, father and husband, and I appreciate the fact that you'd be willing to give back to all of our audience with what you bring for you. Thank you very much, Dylan. If people want more from you, how can they get a hold of you? Or maybe they need to leave you alone because you're busy right now.
No. Don't leave me alone. If you've got something that you want to say, you got a question you need to ask, anything like that, I'm normally super responsive on my Instagram with the handle being the Hybrid Raccoon. You know, that getting all the messages and stuff that I got from people following that post made me feel extremely loved.
Mm-hmm.
And just let me know that, hey, what I'm putting out into the world is exactly what I want to. And it means that the direction I'm going and the things that I'm doing, I'm like, all right, you're on the right path right now. So I more than appreciate it. And taking, you know, what's now 47 minutes to get on here and talk is well worth the time.
Thank you so much. And, you might recall, actually I can't recall if it was on, if we were still recording or if it was after we were recording last time. I said, well, you know, after you win the world championship, I hope you'll come back and be a guest. And so I got to cash that. You said you would. So I got to cash that check. So
yeah,
next time we see you, hopefully, I don't know if you're coming back to the Midwest Ultra again this year, but whenever I see you again, I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be able to come back on.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Ricardo's Rules of Resilience, a podcast that gives you the tools to withstand and recover from difficulties. Go be resilient.
Season 3 of Ricardo's Rules of Resilience podcast is brought to you by Triple R Nutrition. Triple R Nutrition offers you top-of-the-line supplements while supporting a worthy cause. Triple R Nutrition is partnered with Wired and Vision in El Salvador, so part of their proceeds go towards helping support their mission in El Salvador. So you can make sure that you're maximizing your potential while supporting a worthy cause. Go check them out.